welcome to the Logistics Tribe. I'm Boris Felgendreher, founder of the Logistics Tribe, and today's guest is Professor Roland Siegward. Roland is director of the Autonomous Systems Lab in Switzerland, director of the Institute of Robotics and Intelligent Systems at ETH Zurich, and a world-renowned robotics expert. He's one of the pioneers in the field of autonomous mobile robots, which are quickly spreading throughout warehouses and logistics operations around the world. Our host Marco Prügelmeier talked to Roland about the history and evolution of AMRs, what the newest developments are in the field, and what the future holds for robots and autonomous vehicles and logistics and our society at large. Super interesting conversation that I hope you will enjoy. Before we get started, a quick thanks to our supporters Grey Orange. Grey Orange automates warehouse operations through a combination of AI, software, and autonomous mobile robots. Grey Orange systems are in place at some very prominent companies such as IKEA or the Danish household goods and furniture retailer Jysk. If you're looking to get your warehouse and fulfillment operations to the next level with the help of autonomous robots and automation, you should definitely have Grey Orange on your list. Check them out at greyorange.com. All right, and now let's move on to the show with Professor Roland Siegward. Enjoy.
Hello, Roland. Welcome to the Logistics Tribe.
Hello. A pleasure to be here.
Yes. I was looking forward to talk to you for a long time because you are one of the first people that at least I know that had to do with so-called AMRs, autonomous mobile robots, and that was a big chunk of your work so far. But maybe why don't you introduce yourself a little bit to our audience?
Yes, indeed. I'm working on autonomous mobile robots since roughly about 25 years. Now, of course, I was not the first. There have been other people working on this, but I'm probably known working on this because I wrote also early on a book which is the topic is autonomous mobile robots, which was, I think, at the right time because this new technology came up and was more and more useful for real applications.
I think the book is called Introduction to Autonomous Mobile Robots, right? And this must be one of the first ones that mentioned the new term AMRs, basically. Or were there a lot of books before that? When was it coming out?
It was, I don't remember exactly, but I think it was 2005, 6, so there around. I would have to look it up. Mm-hmm. And of course, this probably was somewhat the first book which had really a strong focus on autonomous mobile robots. But there have been other books which really presented some of these new technologies which are linked with sensing and perception, but also mobility. Which were also books about how to build your small personal robots to do some exercises or make some tests in the lab.
And how did you get to that topic, Roland? What was your first connection to AMRs?
Actually, my first connection was probably about 4 years ago. When I was not directly heavily involved in the project, but I was working at ETH as a PhD student, and there was a project which was called the Postman Robot, which was really also pushing this vision that we develop a robot which can deliver posts and parcels within the building of ETH Zurich. This was early on, and I was then for a while also more involved as a postdoc in this project. But then really the main involvement in this was when I started as a young professor at EPFL in Lausanne in 96, where we had really a dedication to focus on this new type of robots, which allow mobility in contrast to all these industrial robots, which are somewhat stationary, which have a lot of advantages, which were already well established in industry. But the mobility really offers a new capabilities, but also opens a lot of new challenges.
And what were the first use cases that you were working on? Were they already in the logistics field, or was this coming from the military or from the postal, or where did the first use cases come from?
In principle, of course, research is not so strongly directly use case driven, but it's more or less driven with some of the challenges in moving around. But as mentioned, the postal service robot was somewhat a logistic robot. It was actually demonstrated at ETH Zurich around 95, 94, 95. But it was never in daily operation. But it was actually an interesting one of the first robots, which was really using onboard sensing to freely navigate in our buildings. And in my case at EPFL, then I continued also with a lot of robotics for space applications. Mm-hmm. So this was also the moment this Mars exploration, also the European Space Agency had some work on this, where it was on one side on the design of novel type of robots, which are more in rough terrain, adapted to different environments like you would encounter this on Mars, but also the whole navigation with it. Which is linked with it.
And navigation is, of course, a big topic if you mention AMRs, right? Because there is something called SLAM. I have to mention that we already did a podcast episode on SLAM and on the technology of SLAM with Cyril Stachnis, who actually was working also with you for some time, right?
Yes.
But that was a very technical episode on how does SLAM work and what was the involvement or the steps of SLAM. I would be interested in what was, in your point of view, the history of the AMRs since the beginning. Could you lead us to some of the steps that you see there and maybe some episodes out of your 30 years of experience with AMRs?
Yeah, so to my best knowledge, more or less the first group which was really working on trying to have mobile robots which use onboard sensing for free navigation was actually at the Stanford Research Institute. Where they had still very limited sensor capabilities. So it was the moment where you used ultrasound mainly. Cameras were not really ready to do this. Laser were not ready. And so they showed actually the first steps. And then I think the big move and the big change came with the laser sensors. Mm-hmm. In the beginning, it was measuring one plane, but this was enough for doing a pretty good navigation in structured indoor environments where you can assume that the walls are vertical. And so if you see at one height, then you know more or less where you are. And I think this was a big change in this field. So it's very often it's somewhat the sensor technology which makes change, also the calculation power which was available. And there is, of course, Cyril has grown out of the group of Wolfram Burgert and Sebastian Truhn and Dieter Fox, which were some of the pioneers using this laser technology together with localization and then SLAM very extensively. And we also did more or less in parallel also this. So we had actually in 2002 the first really large installation of 10 robots working for half a year in a human cluttered environment at an exhibition, showing people around. Mm-hmm. And so this was feasible because we had this laser technology and, of course, a lot of inspiration also from other groups, mainly also from the group of Wolfram Burgert, Sebastian Truhn, and Dieter Fox, which worked at this time or just before mainly together and pushed this field.
And what kind of robots were those, Roland, the one that you showed at the exhibition?
Yes, it was a robot which had a base which was equipped with two lasers, a differential drive system, mm-hmm. Somewhat round nearly. And then they had some sort of a very simplified head with cameras in the eye so that they could mm-hmm. look to its people. And these robots had to actually bring or guide people through an exhibition. This was the Swiss Expo 2002, mm-hmm. which is happening in Switzerland every about 20 years, an exhibition where you show the public a lot of new technology and crazy ideas. And it was a great opportunity. It was also very, very difficult to do this at this time.
I can imagine,
these robots have seen a couple hundred thousand people. Yeah. And we're actually working extremely reliably, typically about 10 hours a day.
What was the feedback of the people seeing those robots for the first time?
Yeah, in principle, we learned also a lot about the perception and actually then the question also how these robots should appear and interact with people. We had actually even some speech synthesis. So you could give in text and so at some position in this exhibition, the robots spoke to the people. Now, people will then immediately imagine or think that if the robot can speak to them, they can also speak to the robot, and the robot should understand. But of course, at this
back then, that was not possible yet.
It was not possible. And so there was a lot of interesting elements. And then of course, then it was also interesting to see that people really like to play with robots. So they try to fake it to see what happens if I'm standing always in front of the robot. And we had some actually interesting elements. This sound, what you have typically on a car, we had this in the robot. And if there was somebody standing in front of a robot for a while, it started to boop. Mm-hmm. And this is actually very easy to understand for people.
Uh-huh. Okay. and anything coming out of this expo, like special requests from companies, can you build us that or this or so? What do you remember about that?
Of course, one thing which came out of it is that we started a company because we had to build about 12 robots. And this you cannot do at a university. So we started a company, which is was called Bluebotics, which is still now a company which is doing autonomous mobile robots for industrial settings like forklifts and stuff like this, but also in logistics in general. Mm-hmm. Which was actually originated by this project on one side. On the other side, we had a very interesting another project, which was, again, somewhat linked with artists, where it was a robot theater. So we had three robots, which had to were actors in a theater play. And the story about the play was that there was a nerd living somewhat nearly alone, but still had some contact, and he invited a female, which he was somewhat in love with it, and he trained with robot how he should behave and so on. And it was really a very, very fascinating story. And of course, at the end, it was it totally failed because the robot was acting as the actor was doing it. But the female came to his house, and she did react totally different, and he was totally confused. And so then he actually designed his own robot instead of having a real human female.
But the real robots performed well in this play?
Yes, it was, and I think it's still the case today. So robots cannot improvise. So it actually was a very difficult task for the actors, because the actors had actually to act with the robot. They knew exactly how the robot will move, and they had to follow. So they could actually not improvise and if something goes wrong. But it actually worked pretty nicely. Unfortunately, we had not too many shows because it's extremely expensive. It would still be today, but then it was even more expensive. So if you want to go, we were on a tour, but only a few places. The dream in the beginning was to go for a world tour, but it was so expensive because you have to travel all with the equipment, and then you need the specialists to run these robots. And so it was a little bit disappointing at the end that we didn't find we would have needed probably 10 million to really go around the world with this robot theater.
Would it be easier today? What do you think? With today's technology?
It's somewhat easier to a certain extent, but it's still, I think today, the actor, which they act with the robots, they are actually challenged by it because the robots will not understand situations. I think this is still a big issue. Robots are not understanding the world. They can do very precise movements and so on, but they cannot really react on something which goes probably a little bit different than it was planned. Mm-hmm. But you can see, of course, the robots were used in dance shows quite often in the recent years. But again, dance shows are very precisely timed. And so even if there is together with humans, it works pretty nicely.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the Stanford Research Lab back then. And I think out of that, the Willow Garage evolved.
Yes, yes. This was strongly linked, yes. This was... I don't know if you can define, I don't know exactly how this was linked, but it was mainly people from SRI, the Stanford Research Institute, which then started with Willow Garage, which was actually a wonderful thing. Unfortunately, it was then stopped at one point, but actually it really initiated another boom in this field.
Yeah, so, and a lot of companies got started actually at Willow Garage, right?
Yeah.
Like also Fetch Robotics, I guess, was also rooted there. What is the difference, in your opinion, between an AMR and an AGV?
I don't know if there is a universal definition, but I would say that AMR is a robot which really can react to changes and does not need changes of the environment to actually move in the environment. So it uses its own sensors and can react and avoid collisions, take a different route if it's needed. And AGVs are typically in much more structured in a way environment. So they follow a line, or they have very specific markers which allow them to precisely move. But if there is a change in the setting of the setup of the factory, for example, you have to change the special markers, for example. And if very often the AGVs, they cannot react. If something is, for example, somebody puts a pallet in front of the robot on its trajectory, it will just be stuck there. At the most mobile robots, AMRs, they will actually find a way around it and just continue. So it's somewhat next generation, which means that these systems can handle much more unstructured environment, which is actually the big challenge with in general mobile robot platforms. If you compare it also with industrial robots, which are typically in a very structured environment, and of course they're even not moving, and all of a sudden you have robots which can move out more or less wherever they want, and they can have really very surprising situations, which you in a production line you don't have surprising situations. Typically.
Sometimes. So it's a lot about more flexibility, right? So that you are more flexible in terms of changing the pickup station and the drop-off point and the route itself. Maybe you don't even choose the route, that the AMR is choosing the route by himself, the best route for his task. But still, a lot of people today, especially in the logistics automation world, of course, they are bringing the argument, okay, but we don't need that flexibility. It's useless. It's not actually needed, because if there is a pallet in the way, it shouldn't be standing there anyways. Yeah, so you should get the pallet out of the way. So what do you say to those people?
Yeah, of course, I think today the logistics, especially the back end where you store your material, is actually built together with the technology which was available. And they have very good and efficient solutions. So the warehouses are built so that you can automate them in a very simple way. And so there is probably not much need to change this. You can optimize the volume you can stock in. But if you go to a logistics center today, and I was recently in a couple of tents also to see what was happening there, there is still the need of a lot of people, because you have these interfaces. So in the back end, you have the fully automated system with whatever little trains moving around or whatever. But then at one point, you will start to improvise in a way, because there is a truck coming and you have to load the truck. And the truck is not always at the same place. And then you have to get pallets from different places in the same truck and so on. I think there is still a lot of potential. Now, the problem is that from the back end in the warehouse to this problem with loading the truck, it's exponentially more complex. So this is not fully solved today. So that's the reason I think where it's autonomous mobile robots are still have to show that they can do and operate very reliably in very complex environment. And that's still also some elements are in the research field, so that we have to solve some elements before this can be ready. Humans are forklifts driven by humans. Humans are extremely good in improvising and whatever. Mm. And as soon as you want to do the same, exactly the same job, with robots, it's very challenging. Now you have probably, and this will be done more and more, that also this interface area where the trucks are and whatever the loading area is, will become a little bit more structured. And then it's feasible with robots. It's not fully structured, but at least more.
So probably we also have to change the logistics processes to a part, right? To enable it for AMRs and for more automation than we had in the beginning with AGVs.
Yes, absolutely. And this, I think, is, of course, the researchers and are dreaming of the mobile platform which can do everything what humans can do, but we are still pretty far from there. Imagine now if you want to actually deliver parcels to individual houses. Of course, driving in a housing area, I think it's solved today. In principle, you can do this. There is still the question of legal and where will they drive? Are they driving on the street or the sidewalk? But the interface with the house is somewhat getting difficult. Mm-hmm. And I think at one point, if you want to do this for an area, you probably should consider to have special mailboxes which are adapted for this. Because if people are very inventive with mailboxes, some are very fancy mailboxes, all are different. Humans can easily deal with this. You just put the parcel in there. But if a robot has to deal with these millions of different mailboxes, it's an additional challenge, which you cannot so easily solve. So if you want to do this faster than only in 20 years, you probably should consider to adapt the mailboxes.
Yeah, right.
Which is not a big investment, and it's, I think it's feasible.
So the AMR compatible mailbox, basically, at your
exactly.
home.
This is, by the way, also what we did with this postal delivery system from ETH in this project about 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. We had actually special boxes and special places where to put these boxes. So it was then delivering this to different places in the building, but always at stations where you had an easy way to exchange the boxes with the letters and the parcel in.
Or another possibility would be to have a decentralized hub in the city, which is not far from everyone's home. And then you call your parcel whenever you are ready to just go down the stairs and pick it up out of the delivery robot, right? So that you say, okay, please start delivery right now, and then you can see it on your app. Okay, it's around the corner. I go down the stairs and then pick it up. Because going up the stairs is still somewhat challenging, but I think we are coming to that in a later question that I have prepared. Yeah. Just for now, just sticking to the AMR and AGV discussion, would you guess that AMRs are taking over AGVs in the long run? Or what's your viewpoint on that?
Yes, I think yes, but probably not so fast as some people imagine, because AGVs,
including myself, maybe.
Because AGVs have, I think, the advantage that you can have a much clearer and easier proof that it's 100% reliable. So it will always do the same thing. It's more or less a virtual track. So a train is also somewhat safer than a car, because the train will always be on the rails. And so there is, it can jump out of, but typically it will not jump out of the rail. So you have only to be safe that in front of on the rails there is nothing, and then you're in pretty good shape. And with AGVs, it's probably somewhat similar. So as long as there is nothing on the track, or you can still have a somewhat virtual bumper with a sensor, then you know, with autonomous robots where you have to localize in relevant to a map where you have a lot of uncertainties from the map and from the sensors, it can always go wrong. And so it's more difficult to really make it 100% safe.
And what brings you, I'm curious, Roland, what brings you to the conclusion then, on the other hand, that you would say, yes, AMRs will take over AGVs at one point?
Because I think there is no reason that we cannot reach the same reliability with AMRs, and they are much more flexible. So you don't have to change anything in the building. You can actually easily probably put stuff in another place and it will still do the job because it can move around. So it adds a lot of flexibility, but it has to first have the same reliability, which is still not so easy, but I think we are getting every day much closer to this. Also by having different sensors. We have lasers, we have also cameras. The combination of laser and camera will allow us to be extremely reliable.
So lasers are still for the safety and cameras in addition to the to pump up the reliability and to bring in other features? Or what are your current, what is your current stage in science right now? What are you working on right now, Roland?
We are very often using both. We started more for AMRs with lasers, but then we actually moved towards more using cameras. And this, the motivation for this was actually that we started to do a lot in with flying robots. And in flying platforms, the small drones, the laser is too heavy, too takes too much energy. So there was no way to do this with laser, at least for small drones. And so we had to go move forward with cameras, which actually it was nice because we were somewhat pushed by the drones to do this. And we were among the first that showed that we can do SLAM and localization quite reliably with cameras. Now, the combination of it, of course, is also the next step. So if you want to localize in a somewhat structured indoor environment, a laser might be enough. But it can be that, for example, in corridors where it's more or less one long corridor, you have one dimension, you cannot measure anything.
You have no reference points.
Exactly.
Anywhere.
And with cameras, for example, very often we use multiple cameras, and some of the cameras are looking up. And typically at the ceiling, you have a couple of elements. Even if you have more or less the blank, all the same walls. And if then you combine the two information, you have probably the best out of it. And additionally, the more dynamic and changing the environment is, the more you would also know to understand what it is. So it's a difference if there is a human in front of the robot or a pallet. Now, to measure the difference between human and pallet is not so easy only with the laser. It's also sometimes difficult with the camera because you don't have the depth information. But in the combination, you more or less can today extremely reliably detect humans and distinguish, because humans will probably move away. The pallet will not move away. So it's important. Humans are also, you should at least absolutely avoid to collide with humans. So I think it's this additional semantic information you can actually extract from the camera. You're missing the depth information typically, but there the laser helps you.
And probably the humans, detecting humans is only the first step, right? You could detect anything. It's a pallet, it's a forklift, it's a route train, it's, I don't know, something that does not move, or a garbage bin or something like that, misplaced.
Yes, this is exactly, I think, where a lot of research also around SLAM is now focusing, including our work we do at ETH here, is really that we want to describe the environment not by geometric features, which is walls and corners or whatever, or a visual feature, but really about objects and structures. So that, because you on one side, you can actually compress the information quite a lot. One big wall you can describe if you know that's a wall with a couple of parameters. But if you have a point cloud, it can take a lot of memory to do this. And if you want to do a really useful task in an environment, and then you have to understand what it is. So you have to find objects. And it's first segmentation of the environment in objects, and then classify these objects. And this is absolutely required if you want the robot to do a task in our household at one point to find a glass or whatever. But it also is already required in a lot of simpler tasks, because the household task is I always think that this is one of the most difficult tasks. To clean up the kitchen by the robot, this is extremely difficult.
Take out the dishes out of the dishwasher, which is often demonstrated somewhere. This is the highest class, yeah, of use
exactly.
cases. Yeah.
And there it's not only about perception and understanding, but it's also about the tactility or dexterity of robot hands. We are so far with robot hands from what we humans can do with our hands. And I think as a robotic scientist, sometimes you really realize what wonderful evolution brought out, what we humans can do, which will be extremely difficult to match with technology.
Yeah, let's see what Elon is doing on that.
Yeah.
With his robot. Huh? Roland, you mentioned drones. What are, in your opinion, good use cases for drones, and what are bad use cases for drones?
Of course, I want to start probably with the bad use cases. I think everybody agrees that it should not become too much really a weapon. And we are also not working on this end. But there are plenty of wonderful use cases because drones allow to very fast collect data. This might be for agriculture so that you have a better view of what is happening on your field, where you probably should put some fertilizer in or some additional water. Or if you want to map an environment because you're going to do a construction or you're in the middle of the construction and you can actually map the progress. This is a field where drones are already very largely used. And of course, it's also very largely used for taking videos. A lot of sports are using drones now to take images from the air. So if you want to, today, if you see a bicycle race, typically you have also images from the air. And this is feasible now today with these drones. It was done before with big helicopters, but it's expensive and not really sustainable.
Everywhere where you gather data, right?
Yes.
You didn't mention the transport issue so much now. What do you think about transporting goods with drones?
Yes, so I think it's always a question, is it efficient enough and is it probably really also good for society? I think there is a couple of issues with this. You know, if you transport a person which was injured fast to the hospital, everybody would agree helicopter is a good thing. Now, if you would like to start to transport people to the workplace with helicopters, and if you want to see how loud helicopters is, I don't think that is what the society at large wants to see. And additionally, of course, it's not very efficient. It's still more efficient to go on ground. I think there is some fields where it's probably even more efficient if you want to bring some stuff up to an alpine hut in the mountains, a drone or today a helicopter, but in the future this will be drones probably without a pilot in it because then you have extra payload because you don't need a pilot. And I think this will come. Also, delivery in the outback or whatever, is houses which are far apart, where you might be more efficient than running there with a truck. But in cities, I don't think that this is a good idea. I think in most cities, there will be a lot of opposition to have then delivery drones in big volumes because it will be noisy.
Because of the noise and... Of course, also the safety, probably.
Yeah, of course, it's also safety. Imagine if you have thousands of drones in a bigger city, which is running in permanent, you will have from time to time one falling down. Of course, safety is also there with the truck, which is driving, which eventually drives into people. But you will have much bigger volume. And I think today you don't want to introduce new technologies which are dangerous for humans. And of course, there is this big dream, which is a long old dream, to use the third dimension for commuting. And there is now a lot of this aerial taxis or urban mobility, which got a lot of funding. I'm not so strongly believing in this, again, because it's not so efficient. It will be noisy. And so I think it's might have some interesting niche applications, but it will never probably become the big volume. Already if you think of the efficiency, we cannot permit to fly even more. and burn fuel and in the air, you typically, if you want to fly a little bit longer, it's very difficult to do this with battery because the batteries are too heavy.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, interesting. We already came by delivery robots. What's your opinion on that? And how long will it take until we will see larger amounts of delivery robots? Will it come in the first place? Or what's your opinion on that?
Of course, as a robotist, especially with mobile robots, I would be happy to see much more delivery robots. But also there, it's somewhat a little bit difficult because there is a lot of hurdles, which are at one point even not the technology. But imagine in a city where I'm living in Zurich, but it's most other cities are the same. You first have to answer the question, where are these robots actually driving around? Because there is the streets, which is crowded. There is the sidewalk where, for example, in Zurich, we already have today an issue. Is the bicycle driving on a side road, or then we have this scooters, which are more and more popular. So I think in a lot of cities, there is no concept how to do this. I think it will be more and more used in somewhat environment like big industrial campuses where you can deliver coffee and the post. It's only used, for example, also in hospitals to deliver the medication to the different rooms or the food or the lunch package for the. I think there we will see that this is still a bit more structured environment where you can actually also adapt even. Now in Zurich, they are building a new hospital and they are actually already planning that the delivery uses with robots is part of the whole planning of the building because they
can, in a large scale.
Yes, so there is a lot of logistics within a hospital, and they want to really that some of these logistics is done by robots which are driving autonomously in this environment.
Oh, okay. I will send you a pitch deck for Neues Technologies. Maybe you can forward it there for the storing of goods with robots in the hospital. Interesting. What's your opinion in the overall about the future of the logistics? How will it look like in the future?
Yeah, of course, there is a lot of different ideas. And I think what people have to understand is not about one unit. It's about how all these different elements play together. There is actually, Elon Musk has this idea of transporting people on the ground in the tubes. There is in Switzerland the Cargo Souterrain, which is also an idea. And I think it's good, but they have always to play all together. Because space for transporting people and humans is limited. And in principle, we would rather have in cities more space for people relaxing and sitting outside and chatting instead of having a lot of parking place and a lot of cars moving around. Now, the logistics has the advantage that you can, the more it's autonomous, the more you can actually use the side hours. Why not delivery in the middle of night? Because most cities, there is no traffic in the night. Of course, today it's difficult because you need them people working during the whole night. And in Switzerland, there is also some limitations about this. So you are not allowed to use trucks in all situations. You can deliver some stuff, but trucks otherwise should not drive in the night. But autonomous mobile robots could actually do delivery in cities so that people have everything ready in front of their building and at the morning. So I think, and this comes back to this idea. Now, there is always this, people speak a lot about the last mile, but it's, I think, the whole chain. At one point it's produced, at one point it's stored in between, and at one point it has to be delivered. And I think there's probably not enough people which also try to think the whole story. I recently, for example, in Switzerland, we have the place where you buy your cars. A lot of these places are actually also in the city. They don't have enough space to have all the cars which are sold later on. Now, there are logistics centers in Switzerland which actually do this preparation of cars. So the cars are delivered to a place which is a little bit remote. And then there are actually polishing and everything, preparing the car for the end customer. And they're bringing this the same day, and the end customer is picking it up at the garage. Mm-hmm.
In the city.
And these are then also a new concept, how we distribute. I think it's we need a change on how we move people and goods around so that we have the best quality of life, I think, at the end. Mm-hmm. I think it's really somewhat painful that we use so much space for cars, mm-hmm. which are typically with one person into the car in cities. Imagine if you would have only 30% of all the roads all of a sudden available as parks for people. This would be wonderful. and we have to think about this. And of course, there is a lot of concepts which are. Metro is like this, so we just move this underground. This is one option, but you have to play all the things together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so how the things interconnect in the future then, and how they play together, right? To get the best out for the people living in the city. But just one quick question, when do you think the autonomous cars will fully come so that they drive without a driver?
Yeah, so I first have probably to define what the fully autonomous car is,
because level five.
Now, still with the level five, you can also say, probably level five, but not in all weather condition.
Yeah, okay.
I think we are still far away from having a car which can handle more or less everything we humans can handle. We can actually drive in the countryside if there is a lot of snow, you don't even see the street anymore, whatever. This will be extremely difficult. On the other side, In a somewhat known and structured environment, cars are driving already since quite a long time. So the first autonomous cars, there was a project, a Daimler in Germany about 30 years ago or nearly, and there was a similar project in US from CMU mainly, which showed that it's feasible on freeways because they are more structured. Now, in a somewhat structured environment, I think it's today somewhat solved. And now the question is again also how they will be integrated. It's much more difficult if it's a mixed traffic, because human will play with the autonomous cars. I always assume that there will be soon autonomous taxis in probably some cities in an inner circle where people will not drive. Probably there will be still some drivers with trucks or whatever, but not everybody is allowed to drive, because then it's much easier. If you have only autonomous cars Singapore could be a place like this, because in Singapore, it's really a lot of taxis mainly and not so many individual cars. So you could just say, yes, in some region of Singapore, it's only the autonomous cars. This is feasible. But today there is no single autonomous car which actually can handle snow. There is a lot of other situations in the fog. Of course, it's also difficult for humans, but for autonomous cars, it's even more difficult. So I think there is a lot of small elements which, in some cases, for example, these tests in Arizona, they probably will never have the case of snow. In other places, you might have snow.
Yeah, right. So in certain conditions, probably fairly fast, but in all conditions, in all circumstances, a challenge, right?
Yeah. And I hope that society will then also develop the concept how to use this, because it mm-hmm. can be really a win or it can be a lose. If it would, the reaction would be that people are even longer doing longer commutes because they can work in their car and we have even more cars. But if you do it the other way around, you say longer distance you do by train or whatever, public transportation, but then autonomous car will give you the flexibility in the local neighborhood where you don't have buses. And this concept, I think, can be extremely valuable, because then you will have, at one point, hopefully, no people driving with their own car in the city anymore. And these cars, which are bringing people in the city, you can then actually have multiple people sharing a car. And these cars will not park there because they will continue to move. And if they are not used, then they will be parked outside the city. I think there is a lot of potential to have a quality of life, especially in bigger cities, which increases with autonomous cars, but you have to do this wisely, and you have to integrate this with public transportation.
As you mentioned, visual SLAM basically for AMRs. Just one curious question from my side on the automotive side, and what do you think about that? I know that Tesla is going a little bit a special way in setting a lot of on cameras and no LiDARs. Do you think this is the right direction, or what's your opinion on that?
I think it's the wrong direction for the next 10 years or 15 years. It might be the right direction in 30 years or 20 years. The reason why it might be, because we humans have demonstrated that it's enough to have eyes. So cameras should do it. But today we still have some elements that we are probably better than artificial eyes and cameras. And additionally, if we want to integrate autonomous cars on our streets, they have to be much more reliable than humans. So I think this will not happen in the society if you have too many accidents. You should really be able to show that you have much less accidents. And the laser helps on this road, because laser is an active sensor. So you are not dependent on the lighting condition. With cameras, you might have all of a sudden two cameras which are more or less heading towards the sun, and then you have some... or another car with lights are shining in your cameras, and you don't see anything anymore. And there is a lot of these issues also if it's dark. And so the laser is good in on one side and the camera on the other side. I think it's the best today. I would really recommend to have both, or even including a radar, because they are, if it's very foggy, radar is then the additional sensor. And I think mainly because we want to have these cars, autonomous cars, as safe as possible. Now, at one point, we will develop the cameras, by the way, are extremely fast getting better. So we have this dynamic range. Today, cameras are better than human eyes, probably not than cats. Cats can see in the dark. Mm-hmm. But we have cameras which can see in the dark and in a very bright light, where we as a human have problems. We have more and more also cameras which can extremely fast adapt. So if you drive into a tunnel, this you need. So 10 years ago, this was not available. Then it was out of scope to drive on with cameras. Today, we are getting closer. And in 10 years, we are probably getting much closer. Also with the artificial intelligence and everything, which then treats the camera signals. But you need first good signals.
Mm-hmm. So it will be at the end be a critical timing issue, right? So if you only set on cameras right now, it might be a little bit too early still. And then you have to postpone the full autonomy level again and again. And others will maybe be faster because they're using LiDARs in addition.
Yes, of course. Today, this full autonomy level is somewhat nearly already given. And this can also be done nearly by camera today, is on freeways, on structured roads, which where it's much less complex. But mm-hmm. if you want to really cover also then in the city and really be absolutely sure that you don't hit people, I would really strongly recommend to combine cameras with laser.
Mm. Yeah, for our logistics community, of course, probably the autonomous trucks is even more interesting. When are they coming and so on? And it's probably closely connected from the timeline to what we just discussed right now. But that opens also always the question about cutting jobs in industry versus automation. Maybe this is a last sentence from your side, Roland. What's your takeaway for our audience on that topic?
So I'm personally not so skeptical and don't see too much problem. Probably I'm too optimistic because I'm working in this field. But
you're a robotics guy.
Yeah, but if you look, and it really depends a little bit on the regions and in the world, and I think in developed countries, we have a lot of problem to find people to do this. Working in a logistics center, doing this part, which is not done autonomously today, it's very difficult. In Switzerland, typically a Swiss person is not doing this. So we have sent people moving in from other countries where they have probably more difficulty to find a job. But in principle, it's not so easy to get these people. And a lot of fields it is. In Switzerland, in farming, a farmer has a really hard problem to find people working. It's the same in US. They have to move the Mexican in and out for the whole farming season. And I think it's much less of an issue than we think, because it also will take time and people will actually start to do something different. I think the jobs of people, for example, cleaning people, which are now moving around with their cleaning machine 8 hours at an airport during night. And there are 20 people doing this. Typically, the turnover of these people is very high because people don't like to do this. And if they have a better job, they will change. But in the future, there will be probably one person doing this with 10 robots. The robots do this fully autonomously. To a certain extent, there will be always surprising situations. And then the human is asked. Mm-hmm. And so the human
also with teleoperations probably, yeah. Right? Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's will be this job automation and job is typically always a transition where it's somewhat getting a little bit difficult because some jobs will disappear. And we had in the past with automated industrialization moments where it changed extremely fast. I think it's less critical with robotics because it will not change extremely fast. These machines are so complex that it's not that all of a sudden tomorrow everything is done by delivery robot and we don't need a postman anymore. Mm-hmm. So this will be somewhat nearly a generation or until the whole change has happened. And so in this time, actually, people will adapt, new jobs will come up and others will disappear.
Yeah, and that's probably even more risk on the other side around, right? Where when we don't get any more the people and we are not ready to automate yet, yeah. So then we have a big risk for our economies in Switzerland and Germany.
If at least most developed country with a special case, Japan, the extreme case, they are lacking people and they need actually automation. And otherwise, they cannot handle this anymore because this overaging society, you don't have enough people for all the jobs which are needed.
Roland, as much as I was looking forward to this conversation, as much I really enjoyed it. Thank you very much. I have a lot more questions on my paper here, including some of the companies, robotics companies that you founded, like Bluebotics and Seven Sense Robotics. I think we have to go for a second part here in some weeks or months. I really enjoyed it. I hope our audience did also get something out of this talk that we had, this chat. Thank you very much and greetings to Switzerland.
Thanks very much. It was also a great pleasure for me and I'm happy to come back to speak also about the startups and how we transform technology from research to its real applications.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Right, that was the Logistics Tribe podcast episode with Professor Roland Siegward on the topic of autonomous mobile robots and logistics. I hope you enjoyed today's show. If so, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any of the future episodes. I'm Boris Felgendreher. Until next time.